And I understand this is the diamond dove. These days, tweeting is something that humans do. I was coerced into tweeting, and I tweet constantly, although there are times when I think it should be best left to the birds. And, of course, there was a time when tweeting was an avian prerogative, and that's what we're going to be discussing tonight, the Australian contribution to tweeting. If you go back to colonial times in the First Fleet, they arrived to find this great dry land, all sorts of strange flora and fauna, and even strange birds, colourful, noisy, cheeky, aggressive. Instead of the soothing sounds of the nightingale or robin, they were besieged by squawking, shrieking cockatoos, galahs, laughing kookaburras, and magpies, although I think magpies are absolutely beautiful vocally. And from the first colonials until pretty much now, the notion has persisted that the birds of Australia had all travelled one by one from the northern hemisphere to our shores. We were never considered the source of such unique and distinctive birds, and yet evidence to the contrary was there all along. Science now has DNA evidence that all of the world's songbirds are descended from Australian birds. I hear you gasp. Across the continent and around the world. But it's true. It's absolutely true. And they migrated from here to the rest of the world, to Europe, to North America, to Africa and South America. Even the dodo had Australian ancestors. Tim Lowe, sitting opposite me, is a biologist, naturalist and author. His latest book, now that hardly begins to describe what he's done here, because it's taken him 10 long years to write it, and he's just confessed to me that he's suffering from a form of post-coital depression now he's finished it. What is life about, he asked. Anyway, his book is called Where Song Began, and it answers all those questions and more. Tim, lovely to meet you.
Likewise.
You've done a great job here in the last 10 years.
I didn't want you telling anybody that.
This is going to ruffle a lot of feathers. That's a bad and quite accidental pun. Even the dodo can lay claim to Australian ancestors. Pull the other one.
Well, it's a giant pigeon, and people said, what are its relatives? They got DNA from a museum specimen. Bang, its relatives, New Guinea, big, and New Guinea birds have Australian ancestors.
I understand that the scientific concept that all songbirds emanated from Australia took quite a long time for the community, your colleagues, to accept. Why the reluctance, do you think?
Oh, well, I mean, I think it's easy to understand in the sense of European scientists feeling that they were at the centre of things, pride in things.
This is the North-South thing, is it, again?
Well, I mean, Charles Darwin, I have enormous respect. I don't like criticising Charles Darwin, but he contributed to it himself when he said that because you have so many joined land masses in the north, so Africa, Europe, Asia, and then getting across to North America, that competition was more intense, therefore evolution advanced to a higher level. So that kind of comment didn't help. But I just
said, I cannot accept criticisms of Charles Darwin on this program. He is my saint.
I'm right there with you, but he just wasn't quite right on that one.
Okay, we'll forgive him, won't we? We'll agree to forgive him, because there are plenty of other culprits. There was a sort of the notion that Australia was a terra nullius, also in terms of its bird population. Now, I understand this was strengthened in the last century by a leading biologist called Ernst Mayr.
Well, Ernst Mayr was 20th century. Can I go back before him? There was William Diller Matthew, just fantastic paper he wrote at about 1911. And he was convinced that everything had come out of Central Asia. So there was this old biblical notion that you had to have a centre of origin and that everything pumped out of Central Asia. And he went through all the mammal groups. But what's amazing is that he started with humans and he said, look, In Europe, invaders always come from the east. In China, they always come from the west. In India, they always come from the north. That's because Central Asia is where the human species came out. And he has this map in his paper with just arrows all radiating out from southeast, from Central Asia. And then he went through all the different animal groups, tapirs, bears, lions, and said, look, it's clear. And then he said, well, there's a rather a lack of fossil evidence for what I'm saying, but that's because this all happens during dry periods when fossils don't form. But this paper, this was in the early 20th century. It was reprinted again and again up until 1974. It's unbelievable. It's just rubbish. And it was far worse. You know, you think that Charles Darwin, our hero, couldn't get everything right. But this was Darwinian revisionism. It was appalling. Charles Darwin would have hated this nonsense.
Years and years ago, I pointed out that people feared whiter, the White Australia policy was to some extent based on this gravitational notion that that all those billions of human sand grains would, by force of gravity, feed down into the vast accommodating emptiness of Australia. And I always thought that if the map was printed up the other way, we'd be more afraid of an invasion of penguins. So this north-south thing and the way we... and cartographic influences got to be factored in.
Yes. Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, to be fair, like, you know, you mentioned Ernst Mayr and... like marsupials, it was accepted that maybe they were Gondwana because you had South America and Australia as the two lands of marsupials. But Ernst Mayr, this great American biologist, and he really was a brilliant man, but also very proud. But, you know, he was saying, look at orioles. It's just so clear that Australian orioles are related to the orioles in Asia, not the orioles in South America. But what he was totally unwilling to accept was that the orioles might have actually come out of Australia. It was just too much, you know. There was the idea that species went from big land masses to small ones, and that's been something that it's been very difficult for biologists to accommodate the reverse.
Can I ask you something in parenthesis, and I hope it doesn't halt your flow? What about New Zealand, the great anomaly of New Zealand?
Look, New Zealand's a hard one to place. It seems to be a place that receives Australian species. So you've got the prevailing winds moving east. So there was a theory that it was a piece of Gondwana with these really old things, but it's now looking like more and more of the birds actually arrived from Australia after it broke away, because it was a fantastically long time ago that it broke away. But it's very useful to trying to understand Australia to see
And flightlessness was a factor of not having predatory animals.
Not having mammals at all, that's right.
So, okay. Yeah. How interesting. Now, you make a connection between the human capacity to enjoy music and how it's linked directly to our exposure to birdsong. Now, of course, I could name a number of composers who would wholeheartedly agree with you, who based their compositional works on bird songs, but freewheel on that.
Well, I think it goes beyond that in the sense that if you think of us evolving over the last few million years as primates, developing our brains, our capacity for making sound, what are the main sounds you hear when you're in the forest? I mean, if you think of hunter-gatherers, if you've got a group of, for most of our past, we had hunter-gatherer ancestors, women could talk while they're digging up yams or whatever, but for the men hunting, they've got to be silent. And so you wake up to the sounds of birds, you hear birds all the time. You think surely that's influenced that those prototype humans, the early Homo erectus and so on, going back through whatever the complicated...
But Tim, it might even have had the profound effect in shaping musical instruments. You know, so many of the early things that tooted, you know, sound bird-like, perhaps there was an attempt to mimic bird sounds when we made instruments.
I think that would make a lot of sense. I mean, you know, it's clear in New Guinea where birds of paradise have influenced human courtships, human dance, human costumes. So there, right on our door, you can see a large number of societies where they're directly appropriating their art form from birds. So yes, I think that influence would have to run through music all over the world.
Now, the early settlers, Tim, must have been acutely aware of the connection between birds and music, because they complained about the unmusical nature of Australian birds.
Yes, so there were two things, I think, going on here. One is just that they were homesick, so the birds had to sound the same as England or they weren't good enough. But the other thing is that there is a lot of squawking and screeching. You know, when a flock of lorikeets flies into a tree or a sulphur-crested cockatoo screeches, you can't hear anything like that in England. So there is an abrasiveness to our birds, which I talk about a lot in the book.
I'm not terribly fond of cockatoos. They cause a huge amount of damage at the farm. Some of us refer to them as flying rats. But there's nothing that afflicts my hearing aids worse than cockatoos. No hearing aid can cope with a cockatoo. You should work with the hearing aid designers.
I suspect that their call is the most abrasive sound in nature. I mean, I couldn't put that in the book because you can never tell. But, I mean, you know, a cockatoo up close, what...
Oh, my God.
What could match that?
But a magpie is mellifluous.
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. And that's the thing, that if Australia, being the place where songbirds originated, they've spent more time here, they've been evolving in all different directions, and so we have this huge range of behaviours and a huge range of acoustics that go with that.
Chicken and egg. Do birds, in fact, modify the environment, or does the environment create the bird?
Well, it is chicken and egg. I mean, I think that one thing about Australia is the enormously powerful influence of the plants on the birds, and then you can go behind that and say that the infertile soil has influenced the plants, ergo the infertile soil has had an influence on the birds, but then the birds are helping the plants by moving their pollen and seeds. So, yeah, you can't... It is... You know, I think birds are a very good way to do ecology.
You can actually watch the influence of birds modifying landscape right now in the Upper Hunter and up through New England through the spread of mistletoe, which is carried around from, you know, the upper branches by this...
Yes.
These little buggers, and millions of trees are dying as a consequence.
Yes. Yes, so it's getting worse because you don't have as many possums there's a lot of possums in urban areas, but in these open farmland areas, it would be possums keeping the mistletoe in control, it would have been fire, and also just shading. Mistletoes like to be out in the open sun, so if you've got a farmland tree out in a paddock, if there's no possums and there's no fire and it's in bright sunshine, then that's a magnet for mistletoe.
And they start very high up. You, as you well know, farmers used to try and shoot mistletoe out of trees, but what with the price of bullets, hard to do. Now, the role of birds, of course, in pollinating is terribly important. We hear a lot about the crisis with bees. Well, gosh, we're going to be ever more dependent on the bird, aren't we, for pollination?
Yes, and that's one of the things that disappoints me, that, if you think about our climate change, what do we do to help trees? That conserving our pollinators is really important, that we have birds and flying foxes as well, for that matter, that can carry
pollen. Some bats, I believe.
Yes, carrying pollen for hundreds of kilometres. Now, you think that if a eucalypt that is growing in Sydney is going to produce offspring suitable for a hotter, drier climate, then the ideal would be if pollen came from the northwest, somewhere that was hotter and drier. And that's exactly what some birds will do. And, you know, swift parrots can take pollen from Victoria down to Tasmania, and there's genetic evidence to indicate that that has happened. That in eastern Tasmania, you can find Tassie bluegums that have got a genotype which is otherwise only found in Victoria.
Is that right?
Yeah. And so, you know, here's a clear argument. I mean, the Tasmanian bluegum is one of the most important plants that's come out of Australia, a major source of paper pulp and it's grown in, you know, Europe, South America, India, all over the place. And its longest-range pollinator, swift parrots, now endangered.
I'm holding up to the microphone. It's a pity this is not being filmed. We do film quite a lot of our stories now. We should have filmed this one with Tim Lowe. The book is, as you can see, or you could if we're on television, Where Song Began, Australia's Birds and How They Changed the World. And the author is Tim Lowe, who spent 10 years of his life writing it. What are you going to do for an encore, he asked.
Please don't keep mentioning that. Just keep that between ourselves.
What's the meaning of life, Tim, now?
Well, a lot of connection with nature really, really helps. And, I mean, that's really a major motive for me in writing it, is to say, you know, to say to Australians, look at these birds.
You know, that. And you, in effect, a better informed public might lead to better legislation, better...
That's it. That's joining up the dots. Yeah. And that's what it is. You know, we've got all this social media, people with gadgets and gear in their ears, and this ever-increasing divide between people and nature. So there's a really urgent need to say... Not only, well, we depend on the environment for our resources. I mean, economics is really, should be a subset of ecology, that, you know, it's soil, water, the resources that maintain us. And we're all being disconnected from that. Birds are the obvious way to get back to nature because they're so easy to see, they're so entertaining, and you can tell such good stories about them.
Let's state the case for birds. You point out that they produce very different forests to monkeys and to apes. The very fact that birds of paradise evolved here in PNG, a direct result of the absence of monkeys and apes.
Yes. So this was something that Alfred Russel Wallace, I mean, you know, the other great man of Darwin's time, you know, he's travelling down the Malay Archipelago. When you're in Malaysia, you hardly see any parrots. And, of course, there are no birds of paradise. And as he came closer to New Guinea, he sees the numbers of pigeons and parrots going up as the numbers of monkeys and squirrels dropped off. And so it's clear if you look at... parrots in particular, they are analogues for squirrels and monkeys and other mammals. I mean, the crushing beaks they've got. I mean, the problem for birds in eating something like seeds is that to fly, they have to have really light bones, so they don't tend to have strong skeletal structures. And it's the parrots and the finches that have really found the evolutionary solutions to that. And that, you know, big cockatoos, they can crack those nuts. And
well, the stringy bark seeds, for instance, remain on the trees for a couple of years in capsules that become harder and harder to breach. We need the black cockatoo.
We do indeed. Well, it's not helping the tree in that case. I mean, they are just eating the seed. But, yeah, you're talking about a really tight relationship between the glossy black cockatoos and all these trees that store their seeds waiting for fire. So the trees are waiting for a fire because the ash bed after a fire is the ideal thing to drop the seeds in. That's the only time in such infertile soil that the minerals are lying there on the surface. And the parrots just come in and live on those seeds.
Why do Australian birds squawk? Why aren't they more tuneful? Why do they sound more like nightingales?
I think, Philip, you're guilty of a northern hemispherism there, which is that, you know, you're saying why aren't they like European birds? And so if we turn the question around and say, why are European birds so musical? The answer becomes, it's bloody cold in winter. When the spring comes, you've got to quickly breed in that summer window of opportunity. So all the birds call in spring. That primes the females. They announce their territories. Bang, they swing into their breeding. Here, you can breed over long periods of time. You've got a lot of communal birds where the territory is year-round, so you don't have to sing at all. So once you turn that question around, it's more about why is there so much singing in the north.
It's my job to ask silly questions. It's your job to come up with profound answers.
Okay,
I wondered whether perhaps squawking was more efficacious given the vastness of distances in Australia.
Well, I think it's more about the aggression. So, you know, the parrots are really saying shove off, and the honeyeaters are doing that as well. Because if you think about a flowering grevillea or a eucalypt, they're just dripping with nectar. The food's just right there. You don't have to put any effort into finding it. So it's a bit like handing out bread at the seashore, that all the seagulls are going to come around to it, and it's the bullies that control the supply. So there's a lot of feuding over access to sugar.
People get pretty cranky about magpies for the reasons that they bomb them. Now, I'm a magpie advocate. I love the sound, as I mentioned before. Why are magpies so remarkably aggressive, and why do they target poor little kids in playgrounds?
Look, this is actually the toughest.
Come on.
Look, if I've got to be able to answer every question you throw at me. Okay, here goes. Well... They feed mainly on bare open ground. That's highly defendable. They can see enemies, so it pays to be aggressive. I mean, that's sort of getting me a little bit of the way there. I couldn't quite work that out. It's part of being Australian. It's part of being a big, smart songbird. They obviously see us as threats to their nests and young, but they are just over the top.
I look at what happens in countries where the bird is hunted constantly. I've travelled all around Italy dozens and dozens of times, all around Greece. You hardly see a bird in either of those countries because every poor little bloody one is netted or shot.
I know that so well from Southeast Asia, Indonesia. I mean, I'll be in Indonesia in a few weeks' time, and I know that in the urban areas, most of the birds that I will see will be in cages. It's a tragedy.
What happened to sparrows? When I grew up, sparrows were everywhere. Mm. They were the most universal and common bird in the suburbs and the cities. Hardly see sparrows anymore.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit to do with changing ways in which food is made available, but the larger issue is the spread of noisy miners. So these highly
miner, they're an unpopular bird. I don't like coal miners either. Sorry. I couldn't tempt one. I'm naughty. I shall smack myself. You know what we do have, though? Let's eulogise the lyrebird, the most remarkable producer of sounds and mimicry
that
the world has ever known.
That's right. And this isn't just Australians being chauvinistic. I mean, experts who come to Australia agree. You know, you had David Attenborough. You know, he presents a nightingale in his bird series and then he goes straight to a nightingale. And when he says, this could be the most beautiful bird song there is, you're not talking about the nightingale.
Do we overstate the lyrebird's ability to mimic, you know, apocryphal accounts of them echoing, mimicking chainsaws and stuff? Does this really happen?
Yeah. There are some exaggerated stories, but once you weed those out, what you're left with is just mind-boggling. So, you know, creaking branches and musical instruments, garbled human sounds, camera shutters. I mean, truly extraordinary.
I love that. And, of course, as you point out, they were taken to Tasmania in the 1930s.
Yes.
And continued to imitate the whip birds for up to 30 or 40 years, having learnt them from their parents.
That's right. So the males are imitating their fathers. Intense competition for the women. I mean, if you're going to be a lyrebird and have sex, you've got to be absolutely the best singer. So they spend years training themselves, and, of course, you'll imitate the successful males.
I have to admit to a great personal failing, Tim. I've never, ever been able to whistle properly. I'm a really crook whistler. And it's an emasculating problem because, you know, every decent Australian bloke can whistle a cab from, you know, 100 miles away. Whistling in bird song, do lots of birds whistle, don't they?
Look, it's very effective in open country. So if you're in if you go into the tropical rainforest, you don't hear much whistling because the high-pitched short sounds don't carry well, so you'll get lower sounds. So once again, when you get back to that European beautiful sound of nightingales and larks and so on, it's very much an open country thing where the high-pitched sounds carry well. So if you think of spring in Europe where most of the trees are leafless, it's the right sound for that environment. So that's yet another reason why we couldn't match England when the colonists came out, because we've got evergreen vegetation.
As I drive between Sydney and the farm, I go through, there are parts of the trip where every time I go through it, I hear bellbirds. You know, you get a valley which is absolutely taken over by the bellbirds. But I learn from you that bellbird song is a bit of a threat.
Are the trees you're looking at sick? Are there a lot of dead branches? Yes, there's nodding. The camera's recording here. Yes, no, that's right. That is a warning. And, I mean, once you know it, I mean, I can't particularly enjoy the bellbird call because it's a wall of sound. It's just saying, get out. This is ours. Stay out. And you'll hear these other harsher calls coming in. And if any small bird moves in, they'll go for it. They are guarding their patch of forest to conserve the little insects that they feed on, these little lerp-feeding insects that produce these sugary caps.
Tim, do you have a favourite bird song?
I've got a bush block in southern Queensland, and the Rufus Whistler, it just does it for me. You'll get a male solo and they just go on and on and on. You can see they're showing off, and it is just like a jazz solo where they're trying to just show that they can keep going and going and going and go, oh, yes. And, yeah, it just really moves me.
Are we dealing with what is, in fact, a language? In other words, are there musical phrases that are the parallels to a hieroglyph or to words?
We're getting close. If you look at noisy miners, when they are angry or upset by enemies...
You're talking about birds, not about...
not about coal miners. Not about coal miners. No, there's no picks and shovels
there's
in
there's quite a lot of noisy miners around. There's one running Parliament at the moment, for example.
Indeed, yes. Indeed, but we won't go there. So when the noisy miners, I mean, I have them in my garden in Brisbane, and if there's a cat or a possum, there's nah, 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 nah. But then occasionally you'll hear this, and that's the call they give when there's a bird of prey. And so I can rush out, look all around, and sometimes a goshawk goes over. And other birds know that call. So not only do they have different alarm calls, and there's another one for snakes, and I can't remember what it is because I only hear it every couple of years, but I'll hear, whoa, that's a really weird call, rush out. And this has happened to me about four or five times. I've been able to find a snake in my garden just because the noisy miner call, it was so strange.
Tell me about the white-winged chough.
Yes. So classic, large, smart Australian songbird, something you could only have here, the only bird in the world that's known to practice kidnapping. And what they do is they breed in groups. If you have a small group, they would like to have more young birds to help them feed their young so they can bring up a large brood. So if there's another group of choughs, they'll go up to it and sort of assault this group. And there's a certain display that they get into which tricks the younger choughs into following them, and they will lure young choughs from that group into this one to try and enlist them as extra helpers.
I remember 30, 40 years ago, scientists were still trying to find what it was that made humans different. I've always believed that it's our awareness of death, our awareness of mortality. But one of the definitions used to be that we are tool users.
Mm.
And you point out that birds are great users of tools.
Yes. Yeah, no, there's quite a lot of birds known to use tools now. So the chough is one where they've been seen using one mussel shell to smash another. But our best Australian example, the palm cockatoos, where they create musical instruments, where they break off a branch, pull off the bark and then whack it against trees to announce themselves. And they'll also get hard seed pods and whack them as a percussion instrument.
And, of course, the death of Aeschylus, where, you know, he's wandering around Athens.
Yes.
And he gets spawned on the head by a tortoise and dies.
Oh, yeah.
Dropped from aloft by a bird wanting to smash the carapace.
And I've seen New Caledonian crows making their tools. Extraordinary thing to see, poking this little stem up into a hole and teasing out a cricket. Oh, it's just just mind-boggling stuff.
Are we killing birds off in huge numbers at the moment for agricultural reasons?
Oh.
In other words, the chemicals we're spraying or...
Well, yeah, it's the real problem is where, where you get fragmentation in woodlands is a particular problem. And so this is now being exacerbated by coal seam gas mining. So if you think of in the inland areas, these little patches of woodland, they get below the threshold size where a lot of woodland birds can use them. And so there's a whole group of these declining woodland birds, hooded robins, brown tricky, because I won't go through the names, but these birds are dropping out of the landscape. But I think one reason why Australians are not more concerned about this is that as well as our losers, we have all these winners. And so, you know, you get magpies moving in, glars love the sort of farmland. And so most people are just happy enough to have these big, loud, iconic birds, and they don't notice all the smaller ones that we're losing.
Hey, there's a bird on our coat of arms. That great big feathery bum, skinny legs and a long neck, the emu. Yes, the emu. Does the emu twitter, sing or anything?
No, they've got a very low booming call, as you'd expect from their large size. So the bigger the bird, the deeper call you can get. I suspect emus are not very bright.
That's why they're on the coat of arms. They symbolise the profound stupidity of their political leaders. It's their job.
Indeed. But
kangaroo isn't too bright either. They've both got great big bums, kangaroos and emus, and that's why they're on the coat of arms, because they're a metaphor for the big bums sitting on the benches.
Well, can we propose a new coat of arms where you've got a cockatoo on one side and a lyrebird on the other? I mean,
as long as it's not a bloody miner.
Communication. I mean, surely we'd become a better nation with a coat of arms like that.
Tim, you're terrific. I'm so glad you popped in to have a chat. I've enjoyed it enormously. Tim Lowe, spent the, now I'm not going to mention he spent the last 10 years. He tossed this off in a couple of weeks, actually. Where Song Began, published now by Viking Press. And Tim, I want you to join me in thanking the best team in the wireless, studio operator Marty Perrella. Good on you, Marty. Mike Pritchard in Musselbrook, executive producer Gal Basaria, producers Penny Lomax, Stan Corry, and Mudita Das. Stick around now for the news on RN, and Tim and I are going to go out and shoot coal seam gas miners. But not before a little something from the ABC's magnificent sound effects collection.
A superb lyrebird, as you will hear him in his forest home. He imitates the following birds: a group of laughing kookaburras, an eastern whip bird, a grey strike thrush, a golden whistler, a grey butcher bird, a crimson rosella, a female superb lyrebird imitates a dog's bark.